Amen. Well, I know you meant well, but you don't want to give a commentary to a guy just before he gets up to preach on that book. I'm in my office going, oh, no, I'm going to change my whole sermon. Oh, no. Thank you very much. That Pastor Smith would tell you that it's always good to have books on a subject and to study from them. Well, for a lot of Christians, they would have to say they're not familiar with the book of Habakkuk. Even people who attend every Sunday might say that, well, I don't know that I could find it in a sword drill right away. And fewer people still would say that it was one of their favorite books. But I think you would agree with me, it should not be passed over. This is a guy who struggles. By the end of the book, he is encouraged. For my own purposes, I named the series From Wrestling to Rest, because he goes from a point of really struggling with things that he's asking God to the very end, I will be silent, I will listen, you do things right. And it's difficult. He observes his family at the low water mark. I was studying about one of the reservoirs in California, the dam, that they had chiseled or etched in their different low marks before, and with some of the drought they've had this last year, it went below the low water mark. Where Habakkuk says, when I look at my nation, the people around me, spiritually, morally, it's hit a low water mark. And he's thinking, this can't be normative, right? This is not the way things are going to be. Something's got to change. And he is his reality is that Judah was loved by God. Judah was the people of God. And in our notes, it says there that this is a text that tells us that things are about to get bad. On the positive end, everything that God does is right. His measure, his timing, his will are all perfect. And it's good for us to be reminded of that in a book like this. So Habakkuk is going to ask questions. We all do that. Yeah, but he asks them of God. Yeah, we all do that. He just said his out loud. He wrote his down is the difference here. This idea of an oracle that we said can have carry the idea in a root form of a wrestling. And when we do wrestle, when we do struggle to know something, you take it to the Lord. So he's going to learn some good lessons along the way. And he's going to end up his mindset at the right place when he gets at the end. But you and I should be saying, but I don't want to skip to the end of the book. I want to learn the lessons. I want to see the struggles that he goes through all the way to the end. You ever heard the statement, be careful what you ask for? And he's going to ask some questions, why and how long, and he's going to get some difficult answers here. Maybe we say, why did God allow this, or what is God doing, or why is God not doing something? And it's good for us to remember that God is working always. All right. In your outline, first of all, in verse 5, take notice. By the way, that verse 5 is quoted by Paul when he is at the synagogue in Antioch of Pisidia in Acts 13. And he says, look among the nations and see. Can carry the idea of pay attention. Take notice. He's writing somewhere between 640 B.C. and 598 B.C., this low water mark. He's along with Jeremiah, Zephaniah. He's got a broken heart on things that he's seen here. And he's watched his people slide into immorality, into idolatry. The northern kingdom, Israel, 100 years before, had gotten hauled off by the cruel Assyrians. Judah certainly learned the lesson and did everything the opposite and had a great revival, and it stuck, right? That's not what happened. Judah has a lot of good kings, and yet they make the same mistakes, and he watched the strong among his own people prey on the weak. In that text where he talks about they seize the dwellings not their own in our text. But going back earlier, when he's talking about his own people, why do you look at the wicked surround, verse 4? They intimidate the innocent, so justice is perverted. It's paralyzed. The law was set for the protection of the vulnerable, of the stranger within your gates. They were to not only treat other Jews, they were to treat people from other nationalities, foreigners who were passing through. And when you don't act on the law, its protections, its provisions, its punishments, then it's as if the law was paralyzed. And the courts of justice stall when we don't get things right, when politicians and justices get it wrong, when people ignore the revelation of God. By and large, do you think that most people are paying attention to God and his word today? And I think we would all say no. We were talking about this at lunch. Do I see injustice around me on a daily basis? And I got to be honest with you and say, no, I don't. But I live pretty much in a bubble. I go from my house to the office. If I see injustice, it has to do with Pastor Smith. We're the only two that are in the office. So I'm just narrowing it down for you. But do I see injustice on a daily basis? And the answer is no. Does that mean that there is not injustice in America in the 21st century? And the answer is no, it does not mean that. In fact, I would say fairly confidently, there is injustice in America in the 21st century, because just like with Israel, when you take the revelation of God and you set that aside, you're going to have injustice. And I think we shouldn't be surprised by that. All right. I am thankful that Habakkuk the prophet is not desensitized by his sin. If he's writing, he says, I see cruelty and oppression and justice. Meh. You know, a response, but it doesn't bother me. He is sent to a people. He's got a message, and he's sent to a people who don't want to hear the message. That's pretty much true about every prophet in the Old Testament, sent with something that people need to hear, but they don't want to hear. How popular would that be? And so this creates a strain. From what he sees, creates a strain. God gives him a message. This all creates an oracle, a burden, and he takes it to his God, and his complaint is basically something along these lines. It's God says, here's God's answer. You asked if I know. You asked if I care. I want you to look at me. Look at me. I want you to look and not look away, because you're not going to believe this, even if it's fully revealed to you what I am doing. That's pretty much what we're looking at in verse 5. Look among the nations and see. Wonder and be astounded. Both those verbs are in the plural, given the idea that all Judah should take notice of this. I want you all, not just the prophet, I want all of you to pay attention to what's going on here. And in verse 2, it says, back in verse 2, where he says, we cry. How long shall I cry to you? And people cry violence. It can be emotional. Hebrew can yield the idea to shout. He was shouting out this response to the Lord. He's begging God to intervene, to do something, to restore order. And so he says, how long and why? And guess what? God listened and God answered. And aren't you and I glad tonight to be able to say that God hears me? I don't have to shout, but sometimes it may be a silent prayer, but your heart is broken on behalf of your own sin, a situation, or somebody else, and you say, boy, it's like I was shouting to God. Your supplications, your intercessions, your pleadings, they don't fall on deaf ears. God's silence may be deafening at times, but it doesn't mean God doesn't know. It certainly doesn't mean that God doesn't care. Doesn't mean that God isn't already working. So you and I should be careful not to listen to the skeptics and not to listen to philosophers who say that the presence of evil means the weakness of God, or the presence of evil means the absence of God. It's not what that means. What was, let's go back to the beginning, to the book of beginnings. This world was broken by divine fiat from God? No. It was broken by sin. It was broken by a break in the covenant, a break in what God had told them to do. It was a rebellion. And God was acting in faithfulness to his own word and to his own nature. So when we see the absence of peace and love and tranquility and order around us, God is the solution. Sin was the source of the problem. So God says, first of all, point A, I heard your questions. I heard you. Point B, I want you to hear me. Sometimes you're dealing with a child or grandchild, and you say, you're trying to listen, you're trying to be patient. You say, now, all right, I heard you. Now I want you to listen to me for just a moment. That expression, look among the nations, wonder and be astounded. One version puts it this way, you will be shocked and amazed. Again, we get more than we ask for. There's so much that is outside my finite comprehension and being able to understand. There is nothing outside of God's ability to do. He says, I want you to take notice. I want you to hear me. You and I can look at our present crisis, whatever that is. It's not the same crisis as last week. It's not the one last month where you thought, this is going to be my undoing. I'm going down under this flood. No. Now you got a new crisis, and it's easy for us to see things with the blinders of that. And it's easy for us, we wouldn't put it quite in these terms, but we're basically demanding God, you resolve it or remove it. You make this thing go away. And furthermore, I'd like you to do it in the following fashion. We have to be careful our prayers don't sound like that. Can we ask anything of God? I had to, many years ago, a lady, she's now with the Lord, and I had to, she was a pretty hard-nosed older lady, and I had to take her aside and I had to say, you may ask me anything at any time, but be careful how you ask it. She would say things in church that were just edgy, and she knew it. We can ask God questions, but we can't demand of God. We proceed in faith and not in doubt. And I think in your outline I put this, we start off with the immensity of God, not the enormity of our problems. But we do the opposite, don't we? We start off with, I've got such a big problem, and then we go to God. But if you and I were to start off with a character study on how big our God is, then our problem would seem a little bit smaller. It would be in the right hands. All right, so then I want you to see one other thing before we move on to that second point. If you look at verses 2 and 12, the perplexities of the prophet start off with a question. How long, verse 12, is a question. Are you not from everlasting, O Lord my God, O Holy One, next week's text, or 2 weeks from now, excuse me. And each of the answers, verses 5, and then chapter 2, verse 2. They start off with an imperative. So Habakkuk come along and saying, God, how long? Why? And God starts off with, I want you to look. I want you to write this down. So that moves us to our second main point. We go from take notice to take notes. God says, all right, I'm going to tell you about this people. When we get to chapter 2 and verse 2, God literally says, write this down. Write this down. He was doing this so not only for his own notice and for the people that he was ministering to, but for generations down the line, that they would, what a blessing this book has been. And with each week that I study, and my study gets a little wider, and now I've got to go even a little wider, but each week to find out how more and more people have agreed with me. It's always best when that happens, that Habakkuk is such a great book. All right, so he gives in verses 5 through 11, our text tonight, he's give a pretty frightening catalog of Chaldean cruelty. He's saying, I want you to take notice just how wicked these people are. The life for Judah was about to change. So Jeremiah and Zephaniah and Habakkuk come along and they say, cheer up, it's about to get worse. They come along saying, life is never going to be the same. That's not a real positive message to go, but here's the first one in his take notes. Verse 6, for behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, who march the breadth of the earth to seize dwellings not their own. So we're going to put it this way. Here's who I'm sending. Here's who I'm sending. They were the Babylonians, the Chaldeans, the Neo-Babylonians, however you want to put it, were the superpower of the day. And as I said last week, Habakkuk is saying, now God, we got this problem here I see with my people. We need a surgical strike to take care of this. And God sends an atom bomb. That's what this is. I've got news for you. I'm sending the Babylonians. Right then, his quill came up off the paper. What? Did I hear that right? You see, you and I have the advantage of history. We can read back and we know exactly what these Chaldeans, Neo-Babylonians, did to Judah, to Jerusalem, to the temple, to the people. He says, with these words, I am raising up the Chaldeans. You know, that wouldn't just be frightening to the prophet's reality, it would be earth-shaking to his theology. Wait a minute, I just told you that I see some wickedness, and you're going to get a far more wicked people to deal with the wickedness. Can you and I understand how he's struggling in his theology with that? And so who's doing this? Who's responsible for the Chaldean being a powerful war machine? Was it their generals? No. Was it Satan? No. I just shared it with you. God says, I am raising up the Chaldeans. That's another thing that was hurtful to his theology. Let's put in modern day text. If you were to read the book of Revelation with all the judgments, these bowls, these trumpet blasts, these things that are going to come on earth, it would be pretty troubling if you and I could not at some point come up for air and say, but I know that God is in control of the book of Revelation. I know where this is going. I know that God is going to be glorified. If you were just reading that, you'd say more death and destruction, but that's not all there is. And the problem is that our prayers a lot of times sound kind of like, all right, God, here's what needs to be done, here's what I want you to do, and here's how I want you to go about it. But before the Almighty, we can bring, as I said, our questions. We can't bring our orders. We can't command. And I get really frustrated when I watch sometimes televangelists that sound like they're commanding God to do the following when out of humility they ought to be repenting. All right, point B. He goes from here's who I'm sending to here's what they're like. Verses 7 and 8. Here's what they're like. They are dreaded and fearsome. This is a terrifying, barbaric people. Their justice and dignity go forth from themselves. They're brand of, okay? Their horses are swifter than leopards, more fierce than evening wolves. Their horsemen press proudly on. Speaking of more fierce, the idea has the idea of something sharp, keen, keen sensitivity, skill in battle. And their horsemen press proudly on. They gallop on. They lunge forward. There's no standing still with these people. They go from one city, one region they conquered, to move on. And guess where they're going next? Yeah, they're coming to a store near you. Good news, Habakkuk. Here's what they're like. They had a reputation for their ferocity. They were not noble warriors. They didn't come along. Persia was pretty much noble warriors in that they would conquer, but then say, you can keep your culture. You can keep your gods. You can stay where you are. But this is not the same with these people. They ruthlessly brought ruin. And God can deal with the wickedness of one people by using another wicked people. Why is that? Because God is sovereign. And it doesn't besmirch his holiness in the least. The thing to remember is that the Chaldeans were not off the leash. I was sharing with somebody just this week about how I remember sitting down one time when I was about Justin's age, and my cousin, who had now been retired, but he had been an L.A. County Sheriff officer, and he was regaling me with stories. I have a hard time remembering passages that I've memorized, but I remember these stories. Isn't that the way our minds work? But he said, yeah, we had a situation. It might have been even the Burbank Airport, but anyway, he said, we had a situation where people would come out with their luggage, they set it down, they go to get some more, and that luggage was gone. And we were having a hard time, he said, and one of the guys that I worked with did some work up in the foothills, and he had caught a bobcat. I don't mean a piece of machinery. I mean an actual bobcat. They put it in the suitcase, and they put the suitcase out by the street. And he said, I still remember a car screeching up alongside, guy running out, grabbing that suitcase, throwing it in the car. He said they got about 100 yards down the road, and they all came jumping out four doors all at the same time. Now, you know, here we've got this prophet saying, Lord, you bring in the Chaldeans, and the cat's out of the bag. And once this cat's out of the bag, sir, you're not getting it back in. They're going to conquer. They're going to absolutely obliterate the people. God says, no. No, it's a surgical strike. They do just what I want. And when I'm done with them, I'll bring in another power to judge them because I'm sovereign. The thing to remember is that God says, this is going into chapter 2, we won't go into this in depth, but in chapter 2, verse 6, God says, I know their arrogance. In verse 6 through 9, he says, I know their evil gain. Chapter 2, verses 15 through 17, he says, I know their violence. In verse 18 of chapter 2, he says, I know their idolatry. Habakkuk, there's nothing you can tell me about these. I'm the one who tells you about this people. You have nothing to tell me about them. So that moves on to point C. Here's what they'll do. Here's who I'm sending. Here's what they're like. Here's what they'll do. And in verses 9 and 10, it's horrifying. They will all come for violence. They're going to be united in their purpose. All their faces forward. They gather captives like sand. They scoff at kings. They're arrogant bullies. They At rulers, they laugh. They laugh at every fortress. They pile up earth and take it. It's kind of like you can see the siege ramps getting built right in front of you. Your high walls aren't going to mean a whole lot when they build up earth and they can just one of these days step over onto your high walls. He says, that's what's coming. That's what they're like. But here's God bringing in the counsel of his will. None of God's purposes are frustrated. All of them are accomplished. If you lived back in the 1600s, you would have been probably memorizing at certain points a catechism and some confessions. In 1689, if you were Baptist, you would have learned this one. The Baptist Confession of 1689 said this: from all eternity, God decreed all that should happen in time. And this he did freely and unalterably, consulting only, not you and me, consulting only his wise and holy will. Yet in so doing, he does not become, in the sense, author of sin, nor does he share any responsibility for sin with sinners. See, that's hard for me to understand. God can use this, but God never is guilty. That's exactly right. So the question comes down to it for you and me is this: do we trust God or not? Habakkuk is looking at his people. He petitions God, God, would you do something? God says, I'm glad you brought that up. Here's what I'm already doing. When he says in our text, I am doing a work in your days. Verse 5, the last part of that verse. God says, I'm already at work. I already know the situation, and I'm already bringing the answer. And God says, I'm judging an entity with another entity, more wicked. And before you bring up an equality issue, that's not fair, God. God says, here's point D, their chief error. Here's their chief error. Verse 11. Then they sweep by like the wind. Some of you have been in situations where you have been in some pretty high wind situation. Out in the desert, on the seas, that would be frightening for me. I don't mean high winds on the seas. I just mean out on the seas. But to be where there's high winds, it can pick up gravel. I've seen cars that were pitted like they went through some type of a pitting machine. It just totally ruined the glass and everything. Just sand. Sometimes it throws things around. As a young boy growing up in California, I got to visit my grandfather in Indiana, and he said, last weekend they had some hurricane winds and a tornado that went through, and I want to go check on my cabin in Wisconsin. And the one thing I remember is that it took a 2x4 and put it right through the corner of his house. It was about 3 feet sticking out this end. Oh, and the other 3 feet are sticking out this end. It's just hard for me to believe that. I've heard of, they found straws that were halfway through trees. Okay, he says this is like this wind. They go on the havoc of a windstorm. Guilty men whose own might is their god. Now they're not only cruel, but they're also blasphemous. So, you know what they, when they had successes, did they say, Jehovah God, it's due to you? It's interesting. Sometimes you see somebody who's just had success on the track field, or you know, and they look at their coach, or they point to somebody and say, you. Every once in a while you see somebody who does this. More and more it's this, beating the chest or pointing to self. Were the Chaldeans giving God the credit? No. What they were guilty of is worshiping their war machine. Every success they had just solidified the thought, we're invincible. I know, I told you, right? We're invincible. We can't be beat. And they would act according to their own impetuous character, their own pride. But God's telling Habakkuk this: when they've done their work, they can do no more. Another power will show their weakness. And all through this, the Chaldeans thought that they had themselves to thank, that it was due to their own free will, or however you want to put it. And the sovereign God says, they're a pawn on my side of the chessboard. I move them. One of these days I'll knock them over. They have no power that I don't give them. Well, let's look at some 3 points as we wrap this up. In the first one, I would tell you that God is not playing with the prophet's mind. When Habakkuk asks a question, God gives him an answer. God's not saying, watch this when I tell Habakkuk this. Watch his expression. This is going to get it. Watch it. Watch what? He's not playing with his mind. This is a valuable process, and he wasn't teasing his faith. In fact, as it says there, he's grown Habakkuk's faith by giving a promise to judge the instrument of judgment. God says, Habakkuk, do you trust me or not? Do you trust me or not? Years ago, I had 2 nieces, basically about the same age and size, and they like to get up on the dryer washing machine and jump, and you're supposed to catch them. One of them I could put up there, and before I could even turn around and say jump, she was already halfway en route. The other one, you would say, jump, and she would pause and look at me and look at the distance, and she was measuring. I understand that because that's the way I am. Are you one that when God says, this is what I'm going to do, I trust you, Lord? Or are we, how can that be? I mean, you're so far away, and this is so big. Secondly, God is always moving things according to his plan. His work is never frustrated. No one ever takes the wheel from him. Usually, if I'm in a car, I'm driving. Without sounding arrogant, I like it that way. If I'm driving with my wife, I'm probably driving. If I'm in the car with my wife and she's driving, I probably have a bad headache. My wife is a very good driver. I like to have my hands on the wheel. Say, Pastor, we need to counsel you. Well, that's probably true too, okay? But you know what? God has never taken his hands off the wheel. God never says, oh, let's see how this turns out. Or, hey, Chaldeans, why don't you take the wheel for a little while? God is always in control. And Habakkuk is learning that lesson. And so should we through him. Thirdly, God was not indifferent to their sin, nor is he unmoved by sin now. God would judge sin by sending his only son in the place of rebels like me. God says, Habakkuk, I am fully aware and my heart is moved by what I see. And you and I should realize that just the fact that God is not judging and sending lightning bolts and striking down sinners all around us and dealing with situations immediately does not mean that God is unmoved by sin. In closing, let me say that Habakkuk, looking through the lens of the law, it says, God, when are you going to deal with sin? And for you and me, looking through the lens of grace, you and I should say, how could such a holy God send his only begotten son for the likes of me? You see the difference in our perspective? Jesus was not more moral than most, a better boy than most. He was absolutely sinless. He was absolutely God. I don't know, I can't even remember feeling unjust, that I've gone through injustice. How about that? I remember one time being in an accident and somehow getting a ticket for it, and thought, I'm going to fight this. And I got to court, and the judge was playing games with me. I know it. For all of you that I've done it to you, somebody did it to me. Okay? And he said, before I had my argument already, he said, Mr. Hamilton, is it your intent to convince this court that we got, that the officer got it wrong? And the yes. What? Okay, let me tell you what happened. He said, no, Mr. Hamilton, is this what you're trying to tell me? And before I could answer, he leaned over and he said, say yes, I would. So I said, yes, I would. And he said, well, the other guy didn't come, so we're going to dismiss the court and you win. Okay. Even there I got justice, according to me. Listen, everything that happens and to my benefit, to me, is justice. Well, that's how we reason, isn't it? That's how we reason all too often. You know who suffered real injustice to an infinite degree? Jesus. Jesus knew he was holy. Jesus knew he hadn't said these things or done these things. Even when they say, he makes himself out to be God. Well, I am. And the way he was treated, and the things that were yelled in his ear, and the way they plucked out his beard and beat down that crown of thorns on his head, he died the just for the unjust, that he might bring us to God. Christ was crucified as a common criminal. And had you and I been there in an unregenerate state, we would have been casting the same in his teeth. We wouldn't have been saying, let me calm this down. Let me take your place. We would have been yelling, crucify him. And only in Christ is there any resolution of any kind. He's the one that brings peace and order. He's the one that brings salvation. Habakkuk is suffering and struggling with some things. I'm seeing this, and God, it's bothering me. Whoa, not like it bothers me. What you just said was the answer, God. We come back a couple weeks from now to this. We have Habakkuk's second complaint, and then God's second answer. And then guess what? Habakkuk's third complaint, and God's third answer. And then Habakkuk says, zip my mouth shut, and I'll sit and listen and watch, because I have nothing to say to you, God. I'm not here to correct the Almighty. There is injustice in the world. I don't see it all the time, and that doesn't mean it's not there. There is injustice because of sin back in the garden. There is injustice because of sin now, that everybody wants to have his own way. People do that which is right in their own eyes. That's a source of tension. There's a real tension going on right now. There's a grinding tension of tectonic plates underneath the ground. We can't hear them. Every once in a while, you can feel them, and it's not real pleasant to be in an earthquake. Some earthquakes feel like a roll. I thought I was on solid ground, not the ocean. And some just feel like you got dropped 4 feet. How many of you have been through a sizable earthquake? That means outside the state of Ohio. Okay. It's not pleasant. God is in control. He's telling Habakkuk, things are about to get shook up. I know it's looking bad, but I'm in control. All right, let me ask you another question, God. God answers that. Okay, let me ask you another question. God answers that. Aren't you glad for the patience of God, that he does hear us, that he does care, that he does love us, and he puts up with the likes of us? Well, this is a good study, a good review for us. And we're not going to rush through this. I will try not to drag through it, but you are allowed to read ahead in this class. If you want to read verses 12 and following, that would be fine. And ask yourself, where would I be in this equation? How different would I be? And what is God teaching us today? Thank you.